Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 665, titled Update on the Meltdown, Part 2. This has been recorded on March 1st of the year 2009. This program, like many, and in fact, like just about all the For the Record programs now, should be accessed in print as well as on audio. Go to www.spitfirelist.com, the best website in the world for this kind of information, anti-fascist research. It's an invaluable resource, and if you're only listening to the audio portions of the broadcast, you're missing the better part of the For the Record experience. There literally is a world of research available for free at www.spitfirelist.com. Books, article length descriptions of the For the Record shows, everything I've ever recorded available for download for free on MP3. So please utilize that resource, because in case you hadn't noticed, folks, it's later than you think. And boy, I tell you, even if you think it's pretty late, it's later than that, Jack or Jill, as the case may be. So please do that. And I know money is tight, but I'll tell you, if you want to stay alive, don't worry about being able to pay the bills. You want to stay alive, there's no better way of helping to ensure that than to support the work that I'm doing. Because let me tell you, the warm and brown has hit the fan. You want some numbers? We're going to be talking about the economic meltdown. You say you want some numbers? Let's try some numbers. The following is from C-SPAN of February 9th of 2009. It's posted by Mark Frauenfelder. It's titled, Representative Kanjorski, $550 billion disappeared in, quote, electronic run on the banks. The URL will be available in the description for the record 665. It reads, the Capital Markets Subcommittee Chair Representative Paul Kanjorski of Pennsylvania tells C-SPAN how the world economy almost collapsed in a matter of hours. At 2 minutes 20 seconds into this C-SPAN video clip, Kanjorski reports on a, quote, tremendous drawdown of money market accounts in the United States to the tune of $550 billion. According to Kanjorski, this electronic transfer occurred over the period of an hour or two. Kanjorski, quote, the Treasury opened its window to help. They pumped $105 billion into the system and quickly realized that they could not stem the tide. We were having an electronic run on the banks. They decided to close the operation, close down the money accounts, and announce a guarantee of $250,000 per account so there wouldn't be further panic there. And that's what actually happened. If they had not done that, their estimation was that by 2 o'clock that afternoon, $5.5 trillion would have been drawn out of the money market system of the United States, and it would have collapsed the entire economy of the United States, and within 24 hours, the world economy would have collapsed. So kudos to the people that at least temporarily stemmed that tide. What's that you say? You want some more numbers? Thought that might be the case, so check this out. This from Bloomberg News. It's also February 9th. It's by Mark Pittman and Bob Ivry. Headline, U.S. taxpayers risk $9.7 trillion on bailout programs. By the way, the URLs for all of these internet articles will be available in the descriptions for the program. Again, U.S. taxpayers risk $9.7 trillion on bailout programs. It reads in part, the stimulus package the U.S. Congress is completing would raise the government's commitment to solving the financial crisis to $9.7 trillion, enough to pay off more than 90% of the nation's home mortgages. The Federal Reserve, Treasury Department, and Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation have lent or spent almost $3 trillion over the past 2 years and pledged up to $5.7 trillion more. The Senate is to vote this week on an economic stimulus measure of at least $780 billion. It would need to be reconciled with an $819 billion plan the House approved last month. Only the stimulus bill to be approved this week, the $700 billion troubled asset relief program passed 4 months ago, and $168 billion in tax cuts and rebates enacted in 2008 would have been voted on by lawmakers. The remaining $8 trillion is in lending programs and guarantees, almost all under the Fed and FDIC. Recipients' names have not been disclosed. Quote, we've seen money go out the back door of this government unlike any time in the history of our country, unquote, Senator Byron Dorgan, a North Dakota Democrat, said on the Senate floor February 3rd, again quoting, Nobody knows what went out of the Federal Reserve Board, to whom, and for what purpose. How much from the FDIC? How much from TARP? That's the Troubled Assets Relief Program. When and why? The pledges, amounting to almost two-thirds of the value of everything produced in the U.S. last year, are intended to rescue the financial system after the credit market seized up about 18 months ago. The promises are composed of about $1 trillion in stimulus packages, around $3 trillion in lending and spending, and $5.7 trillion in agreements to provide aid. The total already tapped has decreased about 1% since November, mostly because foreign central banks are using fewer dollars in currency exchange agreements called swaps. Federal Reserve lending to banks peaked at a record $2.3 trillion in December, dropping to $1.83 trillion by last week. The Fed balance sheet is still more than double the $880 billion it was in the week before September 17th, when it agreed to accept lower quality collateral. The worst financial crisis in two generations has erased $14.5 trillion, or 33% of the value of the world's companies since September 15th, brought down Bear Stearns and Companies and Lehman Brothers Holdings Incorporated, and led to the takeover of Merrill Lynch and Company and by Bank of America Corporation. The $9.7 trillion in pledges would be enough to send a $1,430 check to every man, woman, and child alive in the world today. It's 13 times what the U.S. has spent so far on wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, according to Congressional Budget Office data, and is almost enough to pay off every home mortgage loan in the U.S., calculated at $10.5 trillion by the Federal Reserve. By the way, Paul Krugman of the New York Times, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, although he said that the Obama bailout program would be helpful, he said he didn't think it was large enough and that to avoid a lost decade like Japan had, we needed a larger Keynesian program right off the bat. So it remains to be seen what happened. Now, a lot of money has been going out the door of various places for quite some time. A lot of it, and this is going to be one of the major focal points of this broadcast, a lot of it has gone to criminal activity. We're not going to have time to spend much, to dwell too much on it today, but one should never lose sight of why I have the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, available for download for free, the tremendous risks in doing so notwithstanding, and also why I've accessed the book Gold Warriors by Peggy and Sterling Seagrave so often. Those books talk about World War II, about the globalization program, which really led to fascism in World War II, and the sub rosa cornering of virtually all of the liquid wealth of Europe and Asia by respectively the Third Reich and Imperial Japan, cartel partners of major American corporate interests, including the Bush family. Time permitting, we may talk about that later in the broadcast, but we will talk about, I will write about it in the description to the broadcast. Please use the Spitfire List website. But a lot of this is criminal activity by what we've spoken of in our conversations with Daniel Hopsicker as elite deviants. And no discussion of elite deviants would be complete without an update of one of the major focal points of Update on the Meltdown Part 1, namely Lee Harvey Madoff, the self-professed lone nut of the largest Ponzi scheme in history. The reason why I use that term, when Bernard Madoff was busted, he said, "Nope, I'm the only one involved," and that is literally laughable under the circumstances. A whole lot of people were involved. It remains to be seen just how the investigation of this pans out, but I would not hold my breath expecting for a complete shedding of light into these very dark corners indeed. The following article is by Zachary Roth. It's from the TP Muckraker website. Again, full URL available in the description. It's by Zachary Roth, January 6, 2009. Securities and Exchange Commission Inspector General can't compel testimony from key Madoff witnesses. They're not going to have a subpoena power, at least very limited subpoena power. So again, don't hold your breath. This reads, "Yesterday we noted that based on his testimony before Congress, SEC Inspector General David Kotz appears to be conducting an aggressive investigation of the agency's failures in connection with the Bernard Madoff case. But on one crucial point, Kotz's testimony was much less heartening. Questioned by lawmakers about his authority to gain access to documents and witness testimony, Kotz admitted that he didn't have the power to subpoena former SEC employees for their testimony. We'll post the, well, it goes on to advise about the posting of video. Continuing, here's why that matters. Three SEC enforcement staffers, Assistant Regional Director Doria Bockenheimer, Branch Chief Megan Chung, and Staff Attorney Simona Su were listed on the closing document, unquote, for the 2006-07 inquiry into Madoff, which has emerged as Exhibit A in the case against the agency. According to an SEC enforcement source, only Sue, S-U-H, the most junior of the three, remains at the agency. A receptionist at the agency's New York office, where all three had been based, confirmed to TP Muckraker that Bockenheimer and Cheung were no longer worked at the SEC. So Kotz won't have the power to compel testimony from the two SEC staffers who were perhaps the most central, on-the-ground players in the agency's failure to catch Madoff. That may well limit his ability to draw broad conclusions about the SEC's slip-up and how to avoid similar mishaps in the future. That doesn't sound too encouraging. One of the interesting things about this is that the investigation into this is going to apparently be using, it's not a remarkable investigative tool, but they're actually going to be going to one of the top people in the Madoff Fund, one Frank DiPasquale. The following is from ForexDaily.org. It's a Wall Street Journal article by Aaron Lucchetti, Amir Efrati, and Tom Loricella. It's datelined January 21st of 2009. Wall Street Journal, it's actually Wall Street Journal from, January 21st. Wall Street Journal, Madoff point man cast in same role for prosecutors. It reads in part, as a key lieutenant to investor Bernard Madoff for more than 30 years, Frank DiPasquale Jr. said he headed stock options trading and was the point man for investment advisory clients who were told he executed their trades. Now he is a potential point man in the investigation of a Ponzi scheme that Mr. Madoff has told prosecutors he carried out over decades, bilking investors out of $50 billion. Prosecutors are interested in information Mr. DiPasquale, 52 years old, can provide about the inner workings of Mr. Madoff's operation, who, if anyone else, knew about the fraud and where the money went, according to people familiar with the matter. Mr. DiPasquale hasn't been charged with wrongdoing. His lawyer, Mark Mukasey, declined to comment about Mr. DiPasquale's role with Mr. Madoff, except to say that he had frequent contact with investors. By the way, Mark Mukasey is the son of the current of the former attorney general, and actually, you know, I think Mr. Mukasey might still be the attorney general. Anyway, I'd have to double check that. There's been so much going on, even I occasionally miss something. But in any event, as soon as the Madoff case broke, Mr. Mukasey, the attorney general, recused himself from the investigation. His son is representing Mr. DiPasquale. We're also going to take a look at just what law firm his son works for. The following is from the Bloomberg News Service. This is by David Voriakos, David Glovin, and Patricia Hurtado. It is datelined January 6th of 2009, and actually January 16th of 2009. It's headlined, Madoff's Street Smart Aide DiPasquale was investor's go-to guy. One wonders how they concluded he was street smart. I guess that's sort of the word on this guy. Frank DiPasquale Jr. joined Bernard Madoff's firm a year after graduating from a Catholic high school in Queens, New York. Over a 33-year career, he rose through the ranks, eventually calling himself chief financial officer. For investors like Tim Murray of Minnesota, DiPasquale was a street-smart New Yorker who fielded calls about the millions of dollars he entrusted to the firm. Quote, to a Madoff customer with a discretionary account, he is the guy, unquote, said Murray, 57, a real estate developer. There is nobody else, unquote. Now, again, he's being represented by Mark Mukasey, the son of Michael Mukasey, the attorney general at the time that the investigation broke. Skipping down, Madoff often told investigators that options trading was a key to his success. DiPasquale, who was not charged, became director of options at 1986 at the firm and chief financial officer in 1996, according to a resume he prepared in 2002. Quote, Mr. DiPasquale is a blue-collar guy, not a Wall Street master of the universe, unquote, said his attorney Mark Mukasey, a former federal prosecutor now at, check this out, Bracewell and Giuliani LLP in New York. Quote, he is devastated by the losses to investors, unquote. Yeah, bet he is. That, of course, is the law firm Bracewell and Giuliani. That is none other than the law firm of Rudy Giuliani, who helped to investigate BCCI, along with current FBI head Robert Mueller. Giuliani, of course, is Rudy the Rock, who was mayor of New York City and now is doing motivational talks around the country, as well as heading up his law firm. Again, well-connected people involved in these things. And more about where the money went. The following is a Reuters story, Thursday, January 29th of 2009. This is by Sve Herbst Bayless. It's Dateline Boston, headline, New Talk of Who Escaped Madoff Scheme Sparks Anger. Reads in part, Bernard Madoff's alleged massive financial fraud has sparked more outrage as news circulates that a major U.S. bank may have cashed out early while other investors were left high and dry. The New York Times reported on Thursday that J.P. Morgan Chase & Company suddenly began pulling its money out of two hedge funds that invested with Madoff last fall before Madoff was arrested, but they did not tell investors. According to the newspaper, J.P. Morgan said its potential losses related to Madoff are, quote, pretty close to zero, unquote. J.P. Morgan Chase spokeswoman Kristen Lemkow did not return several calls seeking comment. As lawyers and investors digested the story, they began questioning how big players may have been able to protect themselves from Madoff, while small investors were left exposed. Well, you know, I don't think that. Why were the big investors able to protect themselves and the small investors left exposed? Cannot imagine how such a thing could happen. Skipping down, it's just shocking how many banks did this, said Harry Sussman, a partner at law firm Sussman Godfrey, which is representing investors who claim they lost millions. Quote, they seem to be making loans backed only by Bernie Madoff's separately managed accounts, and no one seem to have checked those. By the way, later we're going to take a look at attempts at performing triage on this just elite deviant ripoff behavior. But again, no, this was J.P. Morgan Chase and Company that seems to have gotten a whiff. They were able to sniff the breezes and get their money out. Their exposure was next to zero. How do you suppose that might happen? Well, the following article, I think, gives us a hint about where we might start looking. This is on the Zero Hedge blog spot, January 14th, posted by Tyler Durden, headline, Breaking Exposé, So Where Are Frank and Charlie? It reads in part, with the public's attention having been exclusively focused on Bernie, his sons Mark and Andrew, and Bernie's three-man accountant company, unquote, led by David Freeling, a question that is intriguing more and more people is who, what, and where are Frank DiPasquale, the 51-year-old CFO of Bernard L. Madoff, and Charles Weiner, Bernie's 50-year-old nephew listed as director of administration, who were the only other tenants of floor 17 of 885 Third Avenue. We now know that Frank DiPasquale is the lead investigator being represented by the son of the attorney general at the time the scandal broke, and that he in turn is working for Rudy Giuliani's law firm. Skipping down, speaking of DiPasquale, Frank is married to Joanne DiPasquale of Howard Beach, who is an employee of Morgan Chase National Association, the private banking arm of J.P. Morgan. Now, I wonder how J.P. Morgan Chase & Company might have gotten word that things weren't quite all right at the Madoff operation. How do you suppose they managed to sniff the breezes and go, you know, I've got a hunch. Maybe we ought to get our money out of the Madoff fund. I don't know. Can you figure it out? Beginning this paragraph again, Frank is married to Joanne DiPasquale of Howard Beach, who is an employee of J.P. Morgan Chase National Association, the private banking arm of J.P. Morgan. As noted here, Joanne works out of JPM's Island, New Jersey office, which is where the firm's mortgage business is centered. In this March 29, 2006 memo, the Island office provided its 2 cents on just how smoothly the non-traditional mortgage product market is operating. As seen in the following representative prospectus from a 2007 mortgage pool offering by that office, of the $473 million mortgage pool peddled probably by Mrs. DePasquale, among others, only $181 million of mortgages had verification checks, $440 million are IOs, and average outstanding balance is $476,000. So the plot thickens. Husband is the chief financial officer to a Ponzi, as wife is potentially selling worthless mortgage pools. Well, that's interesting, but I can't figure out, how did J.P. Morgan Chase get the word that this wasn't going to work out? I don't know. More about some of the many, many connections of the loan nut Lee Harvey Madoff. This from the Boston Globe of December 23rd of 2008, article by Casey Ross and Jen Abelson of the Globe. It's called Broker Tied to Ex-Hub Mob Leader. Jaffe did business with Angiulo in the 70s, reads in part, before Bernard L. Madoff, Robert M. Jaffe did business with another notorious rogue, former Boston mob leader Gennaro Angiulo. Jaffe, under investigation for his ties to the Wall Street investor who authorities say confessed to running a Ponzi scheme, was the stockbroker to Angiulo and his brothers, reputed members of the Boston Mafia, before they were sent to jail on racketeering charges in 1986. By the way, whether or not it's relevant, the U.S. attorney for the Boston area throughout much of the 80s was none other than Robert Mueller, who proved less than vigorous in his examination of BCCI and wasn't really able to figure out who made off with all the funds at the BCCI. I'm still wondering, how did J.P. Morgan figure out how they were able to make off with the funds, how they made off with the funds of their investors. In addition to reputed mob associate Jaffe, by the way, a luminary in Palm Beach, Florida, another interesting person, this going over to the European feeder funds of the Madoff operation, New York Times story of Sunday, January 11th of 2009 by Nelson D. Schwartz and Julia Werdiger, Madoff losses in Austria's Woman on Wall Street. Dateline Vienna, Austria, reads in part, with an aggressive style that stood out in the staid world of Austrian banking even before her bouffant, even more than her bouffant red wig, Sonia Cohn, K-O-H-N, made few friends gathering billions for Bernard L. Madoff from wealthy investors in Russia and across Europe. Now, she has even fewer friends. Cohn has dropped out of sight, leaving the firm she founded, Bank Medici, in the hands of Austrian regulators who took it over last week. Embarrassment from investing heavily with Madoff could explain wanting to disappear from public view. But another theory, widely repeated by those who know Cohn, is that she may be afraid of some particularly displeased investors. Russian oligarchs, whose money made up a chunk of the $2.1 billion that Bank Medici invested with Madoff. With Russian oligarchs as clients, said a Viennese banker who knew Cohn and her husband socially, she might have reason to be afraid, unquote. Well, yes, indeed. In addition to Ms. Cohn, another of the people who was helping to feed European money to Madoff was Mr. de Viacher, part of the French elite, a member of one of the elite families of France. As we looked at in Update on the Meltdown Part 1, a couple of people involved, in addition to Mr. de Viacher, also the Thiessens were deeply involved with Madoff, and I seriously doubt they got burned. You burn the Thiessens, one of the principal elements of the Bormann Capital Network, and you will set a new world's indoor record for death. But I would concur with this assessment. I think Ms. Cohn definitely needs to be very, very afraid indeed. It says here that she is the daughter of Jewish refugees from Eastern Europe who moved to Vienna after World War II. Remember that the Bormann Capital Network frequently uses Jews as front people because it makes a great cover. First of all, what better distraction for a Nazi money-moving operation than having Jews as front people? It also serves as a very, very good way of feeding the myth of the Jews controlling the banking system. When one of these operations goes belly up, people say, see, told you it was the Jews. And also, it was a very good way, including Jews in the Bormann Capital Network, of keeping the Mossad and the Israelis quiet about the worldwide perpetuation of the Third Reich, something that took place underground and something that you can read about on the www.spitfirelist.website. The Martin Bormann book is available for download for free. Remember, in Update on the Meltdown Part 1, we took a look at the alleged suicide of Mr. DeViesche. He supposedly committed suicide, and again, he was channeling money from all sorts of elite in Europe to the Madoff Fund, supposedly committed suicide by slashing his wrists with a box cutter, except he had cuts on his bicep. Now, he also, according to the report, had taken some sleeping pills. Maybe that affected his aim, but still, missing, when you're aiming to cut your wrist, slicing your bicep by mistake, that's a pretty big miss. Of course, maybe that just alludes to the long arm of the law. We're going to conclude there are these sorts of massive ripoffs, and the Stanford Fund is now coming under scrutiny. So have a great many others. Belatedly, law enforcement is starting to take a very good look at these enormous ripoffs and the tremendous role they're playing in the global capital hemorrhaging. New York Times of February 13th, 2009 had this good news. It's an article by Andrew Ross Sorkin, New Powers Sought to Fight Financial Fraud. And as we looked at in our last interview with Lucy Commissar, the brilliant expert on offshore, Barack Obama was one of the co-authors of legislation to close some of these offshore ripoff centers. This article reads in part, the Justice Department is seeking expanded powers to prosecute offshore tax evasion and other financial crimes, including those related to the mortgage industry and potential misuse of government bailout money, the New York Times' Lindley Browning reports. The efforts, which have gained traction in recent weeks, could give the agency tougher prosecutorial tools to combat fraud amid the economic downturn. As part of the effort, the agency has thrown its weight behind a Senate anti-fraud bill that, if passed, would make it easier for the agency to apply money laundering statutes in cases of suspected tax evasion, particularly those involving offshore accounts. Hear, hear, says Dave. Continuing, a top Justice Department official laid out the aims on Wednesday in comments at a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on the bill known as the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009. Money laundering statutes generally carry stiffer penalties, are regarded more seriously by courts, and make it easier for prosecutors to force defendants to forfeit assets and make restitution, said Robert G. Morvillo, a white-collar criminal defense lawyer in New York. The Justice Department also wants to amend the criminal code to include broader definitions of financial institutions and mortgage lenders, and to extend bank fraud statutes to non-bank companies, particularly private mortgage lenders like Countrywide. It is also pushing Congress to amend the current major fraud statute to apply to any illegal transactions under the $700 billion Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP, and to the multi-billion dollar stimulus package. The anti-fraud bill was introduced last week by Patrick J. Leahy, Democrat of Vermont, the committee's chairman, and Charles E. Grassley, Republican of Iowa, a senior member. The bill also seeks money to hire more prosecutors and investigators in various agencies. Rita M. Glavin, acting Assistant Attorney General of the Justice Department's Criminal Division, told the hearing that, quote, due to the rapid globalization of the financial system, again quoting, we have seen the development of a troubling growth of income tax evasion, unquote, that often involves, again quoting, the same methods and mechanisms as money laundering schemes, unquote, according to a transcript. So some people are starting to move on maybe closing some of these loopholes and trying to investigate where, I'm not going to call it funny money. This is very unfunny money indeed. But the loopholes definitely need to be closed, whether this is closing the door after the horse has left, closing the barn door after the horse has left, remains to be determined. Certainly, I think all of us, the horse may have left the barn, but we're stuck with what the horse left behind, aren't we? This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 665, Update on the Meltdown, Part 2, being recorded on March 1st of 2009. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.